The attack came on a dank gray afternoon, with thin rains spitting out of a low sky and visibility just reaching from the parapet of the exercise courtyard to the administrative offices. Gellin Meharry had outside duty and had checked the first three posts when he found that number four was missing. Even as he thumbed the control on his comm unit, he felt the prickles rising on his arms. Not at night, after all, but with enough daylight to see if his body caught on any of the rocks.
Fire's here.
Gellin hadn't seriously suspected Spires.
Number four outside post's empty. Should be Madal. Has he called in?
No, Corporal. Want me to check sick bay?
Request backup at this post, and run a comm check on the others, would you? Then check sick bay.
Sure thing.
Gellin looked around. Number four post gave its occupant a view of the prisoner's exercise court, the entrance block beyond, the upper part of the administrative block overlooking the forecourt, which was itself out of sight, and the peak of the stack itself rising beyond that. To his left, he could see the helmet of number three post. To his right and down, on the outside of the entrance block, he should have seen the bright dot that was number five. He didn't. He leaned out over the parapet of number four to check the path below. There, far below, a bright yellow splotch and the white dot near it.
Spires, this is Corporal Meharry again. There's a man down on the west side path. Have you raised number five yet?
No, Corporal. Sergeant says he's on the way. You want me to call medical?
Better do it. I'll go down and see.
As the blow fell, he lunged forward so that his skull took less than the intended blow. The unexpectedness of that lunge loosened his captor's grip, and he got in another good shove as he went over the edge. For an instant, hanging in the air with the sea spread out below him, he was euphoric. They hadn't knocked him out. His plan would work. Then he was close enough to see the height of the waves, mere wrinkles from above, here taller than he was, and smashing into the sharp rocks. He plunged into water so cold it took his breath, with force enough to nearly knock him out. He fought his way to the surface by blind instinct, helped by the surge of the rising tide. When he shook the water from his eyes, he saw a black wall rushing toward him, covered with sharp shells. He threw out his arms. The water slammed him into the rock with crushing force, but the PPU gloves protected his hands and then his body from the sharp edges of the shells, and the wrist grapples locked onto the surface. When the water dragged back, he was able to stay on the rock. In that brief second, he curled up, jamming his boots into a crack, and deployed the PPU's lower grapples. The grapples held, his arms and legs strained. As a wave receded, he released the wrist grapples, flung himself upward, and locked the wrists again, just as the next wave hit. Minute by minute, he fought his way upward, racing the tide and the limits of his own strength. Distant clamor battered his hearing, even over the roar and suck of the waves. He looked upward, only to get a faceful of cold water. Just above high tide, well within the splash zone, he clung to the rock. Despite the PPU, he was chilled. Without it, he would have been dead. He could feel his arms and legs stiffening from both cold and bruising, and out there somewhere, the killers were looking for him. Gellin stripped off the last of his duty uniform, ripping it free with the grapple claws of the PPU. He hoped it would look like the damage of sea creatures if the killers spotted it. Underneath, the PPU's programmable outer surface took on the mottled, dark color of the rock. Now, if they looked down, they would see only rock, not a splash of yellow. He unhooked and unrolled the hood and pulled it over his head. At once, he felt better. The hood cut the wind chill. He sealed it close around his face, then pulled up the face mask. The last bite of the wind disappeared. He wasn't comfortable, but he was no longer in danger of hypothermia. Not soon, anyway. He touched the controls on his chest, and the PPU's circuitry delivered a boosted audio signal. Another control released a fine antenna to pick up transmissions.
Went over right there, sir. No chance to grab him. And he went right down. Maybe he hit his head on a rock.
Darkness closed in early. Gellin could see lights above. He waited until they were gone, then longer. They would be scanning in infrared as well. Though his suit reflected almost all his body heat inward to protect him from the cold, a sensitive scan could pick up a human shape in movement. But well after local midnight, he moved, stiffly at first, then more smoothly, toward the lava tube where, he hoped, his survival kit was still concealed. Once in the mouth of the tube, he risked a brief flash of his torch. There it was. And there was Commander Bakarian, a weapon leveled at his chest.
I thought they might have underestimated you. I didn't.
Gellin stared at the weapon.
I will be glad to take your ears. I might even send one to your family.
The thought of Methlin's reaction if she got one of her little brother's ears in the mail made him grin in spite of his fear.
Do that. Yeah!
Gellin dove toward her. Gellin pivoted on one suit grapple and slammed both booted feet into her side. He felt the crunch of bone, but she wasn't dead. She would have more than one weapon. He scrambled towards her, raking with the suit grapples. A thin red beam appeared, the rangefinder of her next weapon. Gellin felt something with one glove and yanked hard. Something slammed into his shoulder. Gellin swung elbows, knees, feet, and took hard blows himself, barely softened by the suit. Then the blows weakened. He hit again and again. Gellin didn't know if she was dead or feigning, or if she had been alone. He fumbled around, trying to find the torch, but finally gave up and used the suit's headlamp. His suit grapples glistened, brilliant red in the light. He had torn her face off in that last struggle. An ear dangled from one grapple tip. He shook it free.
She took ears. I am a Mahari.
He was a Mahari who had killed an officer. An officer who was, as far as anyone knew, his legitimate superior merely doing her duty. He couldn't just go tell the sergeant about it. Not this time.
Methlin said there would be days like this.
She had never told him he might have to murder his commander and then figure out how to explain it. He needed to search Bakarian's body. Surely, if she intended some serious wrongdoing, beyond having him killed, she would have some evidence on her. She would not trust everything to an office safe. But not here, not where her confederates might be on their way, alerted by some signal he knew nothing about, or simply by her failure to show up at a meeting. If she had evidence on her, he would have to take her corpse along, or they would destroy it.
Storm coming?
He couldn't wait. Gellin dragged the life raft down the tube to the lip, and then considered what to do with Bakarian's body. Finally, he decided to bring it along. It was heavier than he expected, awkward to heave and tip into the raft, but he secured it carefully before shifting the raft, and himself, to the very edge of the rock. A more violent gust of wind caught it and whirled it through the air to land hard on the water. Gellin almost lost his hold. Even through the PPU, he could feel the water's chill and its power. He yanked the vent control, and the raft ballooned around him. Bakarian's body lurched into him as the raft whirled, tilted, whirled again on the wild waves.
The Serrano Legacy, Change of Command, is continued on the next CD.